Welcome to the Week Ahead in Russia, RFERL's Monday podcast about significant developments and upcoming events in Moscow and beyond. I'm Steve Gutterman, and my guest today is Zhanna Nemtsova, a Russian journalist and now a co-host and executive producer of a new podcast called Another Russia, whose first episode aired 1 week ago on July 25th on Crooked Media. And the second episode actually just aired today. Welcome, Zhanna, and thank you very much for joining me.
Hello, Steve. Thank you for having me today.
All right. It's great to talk to you. Now, what I didn't mention in the introduction is that you are the daughter of the late Boris Nemtsov, the Russian regional governor, first deputy prime minister, and opposition leader who was shot dead on a bridge very near the Kremlin on February 27th, 2015. Zhanna, let's talk about your new podcast. It's about your father and what happened to him, but it's also about Russia more broadly. Is that right? Tell us about it, maybe starting with the title, Another Russia.
So I just would like to add to what you have already said that I'm also the co-founder of the Boris Nemtsov Foundation that I established in Germany in 2015. So Another Russia, it is a podcast about Russia after the collapse of the Soviet Union, but through the lens of my family story, actually through the story of my father and my own story. And as far as I know, there are a lot of podcasts about Russia, but most of them are focused on the personality of one man, who is Vladimir Putin. And there is, in my opinion, a misleading notion that Russia is Putin. Russia is represented only by Putin, and the overwhelming majority of Russians support Putin, which is not true. In reality, Russia is quite a polarized country, and there are 30, probably 40% of Russians who are actually represented by my father. So, of course, the regime of Putin wants to make sure that everybody thinks that Boris Nemtsov is not popular in our country, that he has never been popular in our country, but that is not true. Russia is a complex country. So when, as you've asked me about the title, so the fact is that we produced this podcast with Ben Rhodes for Crooked Media, which is quite a new media company, but it's one of the leading podcast studios in the United States of America. And Crooked Media is known for the fact that it's not just a media company. So they do not hide their intention to trigger debate and to motivate activists to fight for democratic rights and freedoms. So it's also like an activist company. And their mission, so their view is that we should always be optimistic about whatever we speak about. And that is why, so we discussed the title during our brainstorming sessions. And we discussed like 50 different names, like Lost Russia, Hopeless Russia. And then we finally came up with Another Russia, which implies a leap of optimism about our country, though I can understand that now it is probably the worst time to be an optimist. However, I think that if you're hopeless, you cannot act. And if we want change in Russia, we need people who can promote that change and who at some point of time can implement reforms in our country.
Absolutely. That's very interesting, the way you reach a decision on the title. I mean, I've always seen Boris Nemtsov as in fact, a representative of another Russia, at least since since his killing. But even before that, and I'll just go into a little bit of personal recollections. One thing I covered when I was living in Russia for many years was the mayoral election in Sochi, which I believe was 2009. I hope I'm not getting that wrong. But Boris Nemtsov was running for mayor, and it was kind of a contest that really, showed how, I mean, Medvedev was president at the time. Putin was on his hiatus, but it was a contest that showed how much pressure there was and is on the opposition. It was kind of a valiant effort by your father, but one that showed how much pressure the government, on all levels, was putting on its opponents. So it was the kind of thing that really encapsulated the way Russia had been headed, for almost a decade, and continued to be headed, up until now. And I think that when Boris Nemtsov was shot, I think many people who knew him or knew of him, knew something about him, really had the same kind of feeling that this was kind of a watershed event. I mean, I hate to call it an event, but something that just was very indicative of what was happening in Russia and what the cost, of opposing the government, opposing Putin, could be. Now, I'd like to ask also about the timing of the podcast. Now, essentially, the question is why now? The webpage for Another Russia describes your father, Boris Nemtsov, as, quote, a relentless critic of Putin, corruption, and war in Ukraine. Now, indeed, your father was a vocal critic of the war that erupted in the Donbass in eastern Ukraine after Russia fomented separatism there and across parts of eastern, southern, and other areas of Ukraine in 2014. And when he was killed, Boris Nemtsov had been working on a report about Russia's involvement and Putin's involvement in that war, which, of course, is the same war, really, that Putin escalated in a massive way with the invasion of Ukraine on February 24th of this year, almost exactly 7 years after the assassination of Boris Nemtsov. Shana, is the decision to create this podcast, Another Russia, and the timing of it kind of linked to Russia's war on Ukraine?
Steve, I just want to comment on one important thing you've just said about my father's campaign in Sochi in 2009, when he ran for the mayor of Sochi ahead of the Olympic Games. And yes, Medvedev was president, and we discussed with Ben Rhodes that the U.S. administration was pretty sure that Russia was more or less on the right track, and they didn't pay attention to this campaign. And during the campaign, my father was attacked, and someone threw a toxic fluid into his face at that time. So it was a pretty unpleasant experience for my father, but the international community did not pay attention to that. They thought that Medvedev would bring modernization to a country, and they were very much impressed when President Medvedev came to the United States of America, and he met with Steve Jobs, and they shook hands, and he tried to produce an impression how progressive he was using his gadgets, including iPhone, etc., etc. So I'm not sure that we discussed it for one of the episodes, but still it's worth mentioning about the timing. So the reality is that it takes a lot of time to produce a narrative podcast. It is actually a documentary. an audio documentary. And we started to discuss it in late 2020, and I pitched this idea at that time. In 2021, we discussed the whole idea and the dramatic structure with the producers at Crooked Media. And only in September 2021, we started to work on it. So we started to create the actual script. I worked with Dasha Lisitsyna. Dasha Lisitsyna was born in Russia, but when she was a kid, she moved to the United Kingdom, and she graduated from Oxford, and then she also completed her master's degree at Columbia School of Journalism. So, the bottom line is that we started to work on that podcast well before the invasion of Ukraine. So, and initially we wanted to release it like in early 2023, but when Putin invaded Ukraine, of course, Crooked Media decided to speed up the whole process, and we started to work really hard. Did like, I don't know, three recordings in different countries together with Ben Rhodes. So we spent like 7 days recording. And of course, I think that now, because of the invasion of Ukraine, this podcast is even more relevant, because my father was one of few Russian opposition politicians who understood Putin's intentions very, very early. Actually, after the annexation of Crimea, he published his very famous post on Facebook, 10 key, 10 takeaways of the annexation of Crimea. So he basically predicted, the full scale war we are unfortunately witnessing now. And his famous quote right now, is Putin means war and crisis. And that explains it all about Putin. And in Russia, he is regarded as a political prophet. He is a political visionary. And also in Ukraine, he is probably one of the most respected Russians right now. And, you know, I have some personal conversations, phone conversations with some Ukrainian politicians, including Vitaly Klitschko, who is the mayor of Kyiv. And he called me probably 1 month ago, and he asked me, why did your father actually know all of it? I do not understand. I keep watching his videos, and I'm so much impressed. It's like a miracle. So, and that is true. And that's why it's very, very relevant right now to have this podcast, and probably to have another angle on Russia, not to focus only on Vladimir Putin.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's great. I mean, personally, I think it's great to be drawing attention to, you know, there is a lot of focus on Putin. Certainly I focus on him a lot. And I think I would say that that was sort of, that's been sort of the point of, you know, and that's why the Kremlin doesn't mention Alexei Navalny's by name. It's the kind of thing where they did just try to discount somebody who is in fact a viable alternative, as I think was mentioned in your first podcast edition, maybe. Boris Yeltsin said at one point that Boris Nemtsov, you know, could be president. And that was certainly something that people were thinking of, you know, at the time. And also just going back to your, thanks for pointing out that very important detail of the Sochi campaign, you know, an attack on your father. And that was just, you know, that was one of the forms of pressure, a very, very, very serious physical form of pressure at the time. And, you know, there were other kinds of pressure during that campaign. You know, he was unable to get venues to speak, and things like that. So there were a lot of forms of pressure that sort of we encountered, that were being put on Boris himself during that campaign. And also interesting that you point out that this was in 2009 during Medvedev's presidency, at a time when the West was, you know, to some degree banking on Medvedev really bringing change. And I think his trip to the U.S. came not too long after that, less than a year after that Sochi campaign. Yes, as you say, I guess, you know, now it's hard, it's almost hard to imagine that given the kind of attention that's on Russia now and the way it's viewed, you know, but at the time, maybe people in the West were, you know, were not focused in the same way that they are now. And I guess that ties into what you're saying also about your father's opposition to the aggression in Ukraine from the beginning, really, which was quite, I would say, unusual. And, you know, war and crisis certainly is a very pithy, succinct description of what Putin has brought, you know, now. So I think that is prophetic, you know, in a very grim way, of course. I just want to ask another question before we move on to questions. I, during the campaign in Sochi and a couple of other times, I did spend a little time, not really very close, but, you know, walking around with Boris Nemtsov, you know, on his campaign outings, stumping. What is your sort of, and obviously, you know, what is your kind of main impression of your father? What kind of do you remember most about him?
So it's quite a strange question. What's my impression of my father? Because he's my father, and I regarded him as my father. We had a very close personal relationship with my father, and I would say we were like soulmates. We understood each other quite well, and we shared almost everything with each other and discussed a lot of things, not only politics. My father liked to talk about politics all the time, but also we, of course, discussed some personal things. So I think that the main trait of character of my father is that he was an optimist, no matter what. He inspired other people, and whenever I was depressed, I was stressed out, I would come to my father's place to talk about my really minor problems, and he would always cheer me up. And that I liked that about him a lot. He was a very charismatic person, and he was not an arrogant person, which is very rare, at least in our country, for people like my father, because my father was an establishment politician, but he did not grow arrogant. He spoke with everybody. He was on an equal footing with everybody. And that attracted basically a lot of people to him. People like really flocked to him because of his openness to people. And he was very empathetic to almost everybody. And he tried to help if he could help. So that's my impression. He was quite a rare person. He was a very warm personality, of course, but he was also a public figure, and he liked publicity so much. He liked making public speeches, and I was present at some of his public speeches, and he would always come up to me and he would ask, "Did you like my speech? How was I? Did you listen to my interview? Did you like my interview? Why didn't you like my interview? My interview was really great." So
a somewhat strange question for, you know, for
I'm good. I hope that I managed to answer your question. Yeah, but he was really a very rare person, and I think my love for him is actually the main driving force to do what I'm doing with the podcast, with the Boris Nemtsov Foundation, and etc.
Yeah, thanks very much for that. You know, I think that really did convey kind of your relationship and a lot of things about Boris Nemtsov, you know, that some people may not know. So thanks for that. I'm getting a little short on time, but I'd like to take some questions. So if anyone has any questions, please let us know in one of the three ways that I've described to ask questions about Boris Nemtsov, about the podcast Another Russia. Please go ahead. Okay, so I'll just give it a few more moments if anyone has any questions. Okay, I guess we have a shy crew here today, so I will move on unless any questions pop up, but let's wrap it up here then. Jana, thanks very much for your time.
I think we have a question request. One sec.
Okay.
Hi, Nasreddi, you can speak.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes.
Thank you so much for this great sharing. My name is Philip Nubel. I'm the managing editor of Global Voices, which is a citizen journalist portal focusing also on Russia and Ukraine and also writing in many languages, including Russian. My question to you, Jana, is in your view, when you see the opposition to Putin, especially scattered now all over Europe mostly, but also in other places, in which way do you think, or which part of your father's heritage can be the most useful and inspire them to really have some effect, both at home in Russia, but also to educate a lot of politicians across Europe? I'm based in the Czech Republic, so you probably know how complicated the relations are between Russia and the Czech Republic. So I'm just curious of, you know, what is really practical in everything that he did and he said that could be used today to really get us to some practical action. Thank you so much also for your share.
Okay, thank you for your question. Actually, I work in the Czech Republic so much. We had the Borsensov School of Journalism in Prague, and we completed it last Friday, and we are going to have a lot of projects in Prague. For example, we're going to launch the Russian language master's program at the Faculty of Arts at Charles University with the support of the Faculty of Social Sciences. So we are going to launch it actually next year. So we're doing a lot of work in the Czech Republic, and I know that there are some problems getting your residence permits, etc., for the citizens of Russia, but still the Czech government is quite supportive, as well as the Czech academia. So on your question, so actually the reality is, the sad news is that all our main opposition leaders who chose to stay in Russia or to return in Russia, like in Alexei Navalny's case, are now in jail. I mean, Alexei Navalny himself, who returned to Russia in early 2021. I mean, Ilya Yashin, who decided to stay in Russia and to speak out against the brutal war in Ukraine. He is now in jail, and Vladimir Karamurza is also in jail. So a lot of censorship laws were imposed, a lot of repressive laws were imposed, and the Russian government actually persecutes everyone who courageously speaks up against the war with Ukraine, not only popular, famous people, but also regular people in our country, which is bad. And that is the reason why many people decided to flee Russia. Well, my father, actually, if you talk about his political legacy, he believed in enlightenment. He believed in education very much. And that's why he wrote a lot of anti-corruption reports that exposed grand corruption in the Russian elites. And then he distributed those reports across Russia. He did it himself. He would go out to the streets of Yaroslavl, Nizhny Novgorod, Moscow, St. Petersburg, and he would distribute those reports, and he would talk to people. In my case, I think that because like a new generation of Russian politicians, political leaders, they do not have any experience in governance. Unlike my father, because my father rose to prominence in the 90s and he was governor of the province of Nizhny Novgorod. He worked in the government. He held senior positions. So he was a very experienced statesman. And that was a great advantage. So what we now have to do here, we have to offer programs for the future Russian political leaders to educate them on good governance, on how to implement successful reforms, et cetera, et cetera. I know that it sounds really boring and like Russian activists and the politicians don't want to listen to that, but that is very, very important to understand how to promote change. Because it's one thing to oust Putin from power, which is the most important thing to do, but we also have to think about the next steps. There were a lot of mistakes made in Russia in the 90s. We should try to avoid those mistakes to be repeated in the future. And just my last note, it's an optimistic one. Our past does not define our future. Thanks.
Okay, great answer. Thanks for that. Any other questions?
I think we have one more request. Truth and social justice, you can speak.
Truth and social justice. I think your mic is off if you're trying to speak now. Okay. We'll see if that listener does ask the question. Meanwhile, can move on if there's anyone else with a question. Okay.
Oh, I see he posted this question under the tweet. So he asks, what are your hopes for justice in your father's assassination? Any appeal to international jurisdictions or Interpol?
Thanks for this question. I've been working hard trying to promote justice for my father. So the investigation in Russia is in a deadlock, so they intentionally do not do anything to answer to most important questions, which are who masterminded my father's assassination and what was the motive behind my father's murder. So we understand that it was a politically motivated murder, and I am pretty sure that Putin was involved personally. I was not that sure before the invasion of Ukraine, but now I am sure. of course, they do not want to conduct any investigation against themselves, which I can perfectly understand. So their legal practice is that no country allows other countries to be involved in any criminal investigations inside the country. So Russia does not permit other countries or the international community or any international organizations to be involved in the criminal investigation unless this country requests it. So as we understand, Russia doesn't want to ask for help, and that's why we cannot do anything about that. But what we did in the past, we actually initiated a number of oversight procedures within the framework of the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe and the OSCE, and they published their reports. So I think that is important for me that the international community acknowledges that it was a politically motivated assassination, and they also call for a fair and transparent investigation, and they point out to some problems within this investigation, those documents will be needed in the future to finally ensure that the case is solved.
Thank you. I would just add, it is one of Boris Nemtsov's killing is one of several murders of opponents, critics of the Kremlin, opposition politicians, investigative journalists that has not essentially not been solved. In other words, in which the masterminds, as John mentioned, masterminds have not been, you know, identified and much less prosecuted. So that is, you know, it's one of the things that continues to happen in Russia is killings that are not solved, and potentially because that it comes too close to the Kremlin. So that's another aspect. Does anyone else have a question? We have time for, I think, one more. If there is any.
I don't know if I can ask another question, but if not, I understand that's fine.
Do we have any others? If not, please go ahead.
So I know you also mentioned that in view to Ukraine, but I know that, I mean, I grew up in the Soviet Union in Central Asia, so I was always very familiar with the issue and sensitive, but it's the issue of underknowledge Russian colonialism within its own borders of even today's Russia, but also extending to the former Soviet space. And Zhanna, because you represent precisely the next generation, what is it that I work for a civil society group? What is it that we can all do together to help mainstream Russians, including those who are abroad and some who call themselves liberal, to really understand that one of the key elements, the key starting point, is actually to decolonize your own history, your own attitudes, and not just, of course, towards Ukraine, but also towards Central Asia, the South and the North Caucasus. And to me, it's a question that is really bothering me is, what is it that we can do to make this idea accessible and, again, effective? Thank you.
Thanks for that question. I think you've just raised a very important issue, which is being discussed in Russia, not on a large scale, of course. Well, it takes a lot of time and effort, but the only way to change is to explain all those things to people and not to get tired, not to get nervous, not to get irritated explaining those things to others. What I do, not on a very large scale, right, of course, but the Boris Nemtsov Foundation is not a very big organization, at least now. But what I do, how I try to overcome those perceptions, those sentiments, is that, for example, I bring on our journalistic programs, I bring people not only from Russia, but also from other countries like Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhstan, etc., etc. So it's, we need something on a larger scale. We need in Russia, in the future, of course, not now. Now it's impossible. Like Erasmus. So this idea of Erasmus, the biggest European exchange programs, is to overcome those attitudes, those negative attitudes in the European Union. And we need the same program for Russia, those exchange programs, so people can speak to each other, can learn about other cultures. I assume that Russians know very little about other cultures present in the post-Soviet space. And that's how we can overcome this problem.
Okay, thanks very much, Anna. Any more questions? If not, I will start to wrap it up here. And thanks to those who did ask questions and to those who were just listening. And Jana, thank you very much for your time and your thoughts and insights and your recollections.
Steve, thank you very much. Thank you. Thanks to everyone who've been listening to us.
All right. And once again, I've been speaking to Jana Nemtsova, co-host and executive producer of the new podcast, Another Russia. The second episode of Another Russia just came out today, and it's called Beautiful Russia of Tomorrow. So give that a listen. And my name is Steve Gutterman, editor for Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus at RFERL. As I mentioned at the start, this conversation will also be published as a podcast, and you can subscribe to The Week Ahead in Russia on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts. I'll be back next Monday for another edition of The Week Ahead in Russia. Thanks for listening.